Chapter 3. Nature and History. The Dialectic of Culture. Adorno rejects the assumption, as he does in relation to other terms, that nature and history have to be given definitions. You know that I am not at all fond of definitions. Perhaps I could add that the concept of definition has been most emphatically criticized in great philosophy, one after the other by Kant, by Hegel, finally also by Nietzsche, but that this criticism has been afflicted with the curse of impotence. The content of terms emerges rather from seeking to understand their interaction. This may well involve attempts at definition, but the definitions will be provisional. As such, in modern history, the situation arises where historical conditions present themselves as natural conditions. But at the same time, what seem to be natural conditions are actually historical, because how we understand nature depends on human history. This apparent paradox is central to Adorno's thinking, but evidently needs some explanation. As we discussed, second nature, human society, threatens humankind just as first nature does, and also, in turn, changes how first nature is understood. This reversal is part of Adorno's wider questioning of metaphysics, which is summed up by his contention that the unchanging is truth, and the mobile, transient mere appearance, the indifference of temporal and eternal ideas to each other, can no longer be asserted. The modern world involves what Max Weber terms disenchantment, which ensues from the successes of modern science. One can, in principle, master all things by calculation. This means that the world is disenchanted. Science as vocation. Instead of the essentially theological idea that meaning is objectively imbued in things, meaning now becomes something which is continually in question and gains a fundamentally historical aspect. The new insights of physics also give rise to existential questions which do not have scientific answers. If the objective truth about the physical universe arrived at by calculation is that it will, according to the law of entropy, die in the heat death of the universe, does anything in life actually matter at all? Because it all comes to an end anyway. At the same time, the finitude and transience of the physical universe in the form we know it need not lead to meaninglessness. The opposite can be the case. If the only place there is meaning is in our finite existence, finite things can matter more rather than less, because there is nowhere else for things to matter. The question is now how they matter, and that is a central concern for Adorno. While acknowledging the importance of transitory meanings, Adorno contends that the fact that Auschwitz was possible means any attempt to give universal meaning to human existence has to confront humankind's capacity for the complete destruction of meaning. That it could happen in the midst of all the tradition of philosophy, of art, and enlightening sciences, says more than only that Geist, mind/spirit, was unable to take hold of people and change them. What makes Auschwitz possible is therefore inherent in that tradition itself. This is the core of Adorno's critical conception of modernity, and it involves a further contradiction. In On the Concept of History, written in 1940, not long before his suicide in France when he thought his attempt to escape the Nazis had failed, Walter Benjamin had said of cultural treasures, "They owe their existence not only to the efforts of the great minds and talents who have created them, but also to the anonymous toil of their contemporaries. There is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism." And just as such a document is not free of barbarism, barbarism taints also the manner in which it was transmitted from one owner to another. It is not that culture, therefore, has no value. Adorno also characteristically insists that whoever refuses culture directly promotes the barbarism as which culture has revealed itself. At the same time, culture's complicity in the history in which it is located cannot be ignored. The dialectic here illustrates why Adorno proposes what he calls negative dialectics. Culture also becomes its opposite, barbarism. But this does not mean that philosophy, as part of that culture, gains higher insight. Rather, thought, in order to be true, would have, today at least, also to think against itself. In this situation, there is no guarantee that thought will not continue to promote barbarism. Thinking demands continual critical self-reflection, with no certainty that it is not contributing to delusion. The consequence is that the apparently best justified ways of thinking may turn out to be unsustainable. In negative dialectics, unlike in Hegel's dialectic, what results from a contradiction need not generate greater insight. It is, therefore, not enough for philosophers to assume they are seeking the truth. They should also reflect on how what they are doing affects the contexts in which they do this. There is no construct in the world, not the highest constructs of philosophy, not the highest of art, which could not, by holding on to them in an isolated manner, be misused to keep people away from other things, to deceive people about other matters. The focus of much modern philosophy is on the sciences and on the justification of scientific knowledge. But this has, arguably, led philosophy to underplay interpretation of the effects of the sciences in real-world circumstances. Locating the natural sciences' search for an objective account of nature in wider context leads Adorno to his interrogation of the relationship between nature and history. Nature. Nature, in one sense, is just everything, from the material of the universe to the ways it becomes organized, including whatever consciousness is seen to be, on the assumption that without its natural conditions of possibility, there would be no consciousness. But the idea of nature needs an other to contrast with, if it is to have any determinate content. The metaphysical idea that the unchanging is truth can apply to some conceptions of nature, of the kind which underpin the modern natural sciences. These investigate nature as a system of unchanging laws, as opposed to the changing world of history. Kant speaks in this respect of the formal sense of nature as a totality of rules, and as the lawfulness of appearances in space and time. This raises the question of how we, as parts of physical nature, can be free and not just determined by that nature. And this makes us the other to nature, in some sense. Kant argued that natural necessity actually depends on the ways we think. The highest legislation of nature must lie in ourselves. If human existence plays out in history, this already suggests that a strict division between nature as the realm of unchanging laws and history as the realm of human action can be questioned. The sense of nature thus becomes something contested. This is not just a theoretical issue, because assumptions about the division between nature and culture, for example, in relation to judgments on how responsible people are for their actions, or questions of sex and gender, have major consequences in many areas of human life, from the law to psychology to education. One of Adorno's pupils, philosopher Albrecht Wellmer, suggests that a very different sense of nature is also involved in Adorno. The nature which we, as acting and deliberating creatures, are aware of as our own nature, the nature Adorno speaks of, is not the nature of scientifically objectified brain processes, but the living nature of our body, with its neediness, its impulses, its potentials, and its vulnerability. These are not fully under our control, because they also depend on our biology, and culture both inhibits and enables expressions of our impulses. This nature is inevitably changed by the contexts which people inhabit, and so is also historical. The approach here is at odds with the kind of naturalist theory which seeks to explain human action in terms of law-bound internal mechanisms of the kind used to explain non-human nature. Even the status of non-human nature is, though, not something unchanging. It moves historically, for example, from being God's creation to being the contested modern concept we are considering here. The emergence of landscape painting in the West, from the Renaissance onwards, where the human figure ceases to be the main focus, suggests another dimension of nature's history. In a more troubling sense, intrusions into domains previously untouched by humankind, which, for example, can unleash new viruses like HIV or COVID-19, also point to a historical dimension of nature. Adorno maintains that the question of nature as something absolutely primary, as absolutely immediate in relation to its mediations, is deceptive. He cites Marx and Engels. History can be considered from two sides, be divided into the history of nature and the history of humankind. But the two sides cannot be separated. As long as people exist, the history of nature and the history of people condition each other. This leads to another dialectical reversal, which sees everything historical as nature, precisely because it still remains under the spell of the blind context of the nature which it pushes away from itself. The spell of the blind context of nature exerts itself in the ways that social humankind opposes the threats of external nature, but thereby produces equivalent threats in society. Adorno illustrates seeing the historical as nature by the example of nationalism, itself a historical phenomenon that develops at the end of the 18th century, but one which relies on supposedly natural factors, like ethnicity. Precisely because the nation is not nature, it must continually announce to itself that it really is something like proximity to nature, immediacy, community of the people. The effects of this particular version of seeing history as nature remain, despite the experience of the Holocaust, one of the major determining factors in world politics, and Adorno regarded it as a major task to reveal the deception it involves. Second nature. For Adorno, things which are taken as given have historical and social aspects, and so could always have developed in other ways. The way things are at a particular time is neither predetermined nor a product of necessity. What we encounter as nature is, in truth, second nature and not first. And we, in order to give abused and oppressed nature its due, must not allow ourselves to be blinded precisely by that appearance of the natural. There is, as such, no access to what is essentially natural or essentially historical, because seeking to establish a firm boundary between the two leads to ideological distortions. What the terms mean changes with history, and we cannot wholly transcend our own historical nature and gain a neutral view from nowhere. We can, though, become aware of what we have previously abused and repressed because we only saw it as just the way things are. The ongoing battle against racism illustrates what is at issue here. Thought itself is often seen as what separates us from nature, but once again, this is not as simple as it might seem. Basing itself on an objectifying assumption about what nature essentially is, of the kind Adorno rejects, reductionist neuroscience tries to show that thought should be incorporated into nature seen as a system of laws, which leads to ideas like the brain as a computer and questions about artificial intelligence. From Adorno's perspective, in contrast, thought functions as objective nature when it becomes what can increase rather than alleviate human distress or blocks possibilities of social improvement. Some, but by no means all, versions of neuroscience have the potential to do this, precisely by trying to reduce what Velmer terms our living nature to being a technocratically manipulable, objective process. Adorno's view of the thought/nature issue is illustrated when he discusses computers. They show to people the vacuity of formalized thinking that has been divested of its content, insofar as they are better able to carry out what the method of subjective reason, i.e., the method of the natural sciences, is proud of, than are thinking subjects. It is not, therefore, that computers have no value, but philosophical thinking only begins as soon as it is not satisfied with knowledge that is expected and in which nothing more shows itself than one already put into it. The humane sense of computers would be to relieve the thought of living people to such an extent that it would gain the freedom for knowledge that was not already implicitly present. Economist John Maynard Keynes had predicted in the 1930s that technology would replace most forms of work. The fact is that it hasn't, and very many people end up doing what anthropologist David Graeber has called bullshit jobs, in which technology has been marshaled, if anything, to figure out ways to make us all work more. This suggests, in another example of a dialectic of enlightenment, how the knowledge Adorno is concerned with, which would make society more fit for human beings, has too often failed to materialize, even as technological command has massively expanded. So how should nature be thought about? In lectures on Problems of Moral Philosophy, Adorno makes a further dialectical claim. We are really no longer ourselves a piece of nature at the moment when we notice, when we recognize, that we are a piece of nature. Instead of raising ourselves to the status of lord and owner of nature, which objectifies it as the other, the realization that we are part of nature opens up the possibility of understanding how we might inhabit nature in ways that do less damage to it. Adorno refers to this as remembrance of nature in the subject. And such understanding can also reduce the damage we do to ourselves. As with Adorno's conception of the subject, this leads to a dialectical contradiction. Nature can be that which, following the German word for object, Gegenstand, stands against the subject, and has in some measure to be resisted. This can include society, when it becomes oppressive, second nature. Nature can, however, also be what is oppressed by instrumental reason, to which philosophy and art should give a voice, thus seeing nature as subject, because it can suffer oppression. These senses of nature are clearly opposed to each other. There is, for Adorno, though, no way of definitively resolving such contradictions. The aim is to use them to sustain awareness of how our relationships to the world produce blindness to what they exclude, which is why thought needs to think against itself. What is at issue here is apparent, for example, in the changed sense that nature has taken on since the climate crisis and the threat of civilizational collapse have become ever more pressing concerns. Mimesis. In order to explain the kinds of relationship to the world at issue here, Adorno introduces the idea of what he terms mimesis. Following Aristotle, mimesis is often used to refer to conceptions of art that see it as representation of reality, for example, in a painting or a play. But it can also refer to forms of animal and human mimicry. And this is the aspect that initially concerns Adorno. He wants to characterize non-objectifying relationships to the world, which are prior to conceptual thought, pre-mundane mimesis, reflex-based imitation, the however vain stirring from which once emerged what is different from what is given, mind, Geist itself. Two examples he gives from the arts can help illustrate what he means. In a discussion of march elements in the music of Gustav Mahler, he suggests that marches always also dictate something to the people marching by mimetically preempting their step. This happens at a level where people marching don't think about what they're doing, thus in a pre-reflexive manner. The concert hall, designed by architect Hans Scharoun for the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, suggests how mimesis is not necessarily based on identity or similarity with things in the world in the manner of a picture. In order to produce spatially ideal conditions for orchestral music, the hall becomes similar to music without borrowing from it. The origins of mimesis are described thus. Magic, like science, pursues objectives, but it does so by mimesis, not in progressing distance from the object. In science, this distance results from applying universal concepts to differing particulars. Mimesis involves a specific response to a specific object that does not seek to make it the same as other objects. Adorno infers a central point about language from this. But language, by virtue of its signifying element, the antithesis of the mimetic expressive element, is chained to the form of judgment and proposition, and thence to the synthetic function of the concept. This has significant consequences for his view of aesthetics. Music precisely avoids the form of the judgment. Adorno refers to judgmentless synthesis as crucial to art. And poetry has to find ways of dealing with the contradiction between the ways in which words signify by applying a universal to particulars and the drive to express something that is not just the reduction of it to general terms. Mimesis is, then, an attitude to reality this side of the fixed opposition of subject and object. And without it, the split of subject and object would be absolute and cognition impossible. He talks of the mimetic moment of knowledge as the elective affinity of knower and known. One can see this in children's immediate sympathetic engagement with other living beings and things in the world, which does not rely on identification and makes the development of cognitive engagement possible. If this moment were completely eradicated, the possibility of subject knowing object would be absolutely incomprehensible, because there would be nothing initially motivating and directing it. The mimetic can blend with rationality, and this, Adorno contends, becomes apparent in Differenziertheit, differentiatedness, complexity. Thus, in the ability to respond to unexpected detail that is missed or repressed by established ways of thinking. The mimetic belongs in one sense, therefore, on the side of nature, because it is not something learned via social rules. The mimetic is also vital to particular responses to things that are not to be reduced to the universal, which means it is also essential to history. the contemporary importance of these rather complex ideas lies in the way they offer a counter to the tendency to regard the natural sciences as the ultimate arbiter in our self-understanding. Velmer makes the implication of Adorno's ideas clear when he says, "It seems that we cannot reconstruct the history of nature, part of which is the emergence of human forms of life and of the spheres of subjective and objective spirit, in terms of a nomological, or based on laws, physical theory, precisely because to describe what is essentially new in the process of evolution, we need categories beyond those of physics, and not reducible to them. The new is normally associated with history, in opposition to nature as the ever same. But the point Adorno and Velmer make is that we need to be alert to how history and nature are dialectically related, and this precludes nature being the history-less, platonically ontological. Nothing that Adorno proposes here is intended to put in question the results of methodologically sound research in the physical sciences. However, philosophy needs to take account of the meaning and effects of the sciences in concrete human circumstances, which cannot be grasped in those sciences' own terms, and yet are part of the history of the nature which the sciences investigate. History, in Hegel, is the realm of self-determination, of freedom in the sense derived from Kant, who saw it as the rational adherence to norms governing one's actions. In Adorno's view, this conception fails to account for why history so often functions as nature, precisely by undermining self-determination. In consequence, he asks how freedom can better be understood, and this will be the focus of the next chapter.